The following interviews and commentaries are for entertainment only. The views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
It's time again for Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio with the latest news and conversation related to firearms and your Second Amendment rights. Sponsored by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. And now, Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in throughout the hour to join us, 458-8255. 458-TALK, what's on your mind about firearms today? It's another great day in Fairbanks. Sun is overcast with a snow forecast, and the temperature is a warm minus 2 degrees this morning. And here at the KFAR Broadcasting Station, Melissa is yet again expertly running the board for us. Thank you, Melissa. And she's keeping the archives up to date. So if you miss a program, it should be accessible in the archives within a day or so. And I, as usual, appreciate that. So what's on our agenda today? First, let's talk about Fuller Brushes. Remember the Fuller Brush Man? Second, my new Colt Anaconda finally made it to Fairbanks. And third, I want to start a new series of history stories about some of the famous heroes and outlaws who rode with or robbed the Wells Fargo and Company men on horse, stagecoach, and the railways. So today will be an introduction, and in the future we'll cover about 20 stories about some of our well-known Old West characters and their firearms. Glenn Miller will do a Glenn Miller's Reloading Bench program next week, January 20th, on Shooter's Corner. Glenn has had some interesting experiences in his latest travel, shooting matches along the East Coast that he'll share with us. So call in with your ammunition and reloading questions next week, because that is what Glenn loves to talk about. Now, the man who sold our mother's hairbrushes and who sold the government boar brushes to clean rifles in the war years was born this day. Today, January 13, but in 1885, Alfred Fuller was born. And how many of you growing up had the Fuller Brush Man knock on your door? And I remember that. I remember the Fuller Brush Man trying to sell brushes to my mother. We used Fuller Brush products when I was a kid. In fact, I still remember my Fuller Brush wood-handled, black-bristled hairbrush on my dresser. And door-to-door sales was popular back when I was young. And I remember the encyclopedia door-to-door salesman coming by every so often. I remember my parents discussing at the dinner table if we could afford an encyclopedia set. And after some years, my parents bought a set from a salesman, and a set of those books were a big deal in my home. They were ivory and green colored world book encyclopedias, and each year we'd get a yearbook to update the set. And my father even built a special cabinet for the world book encyclopedia set. And there was the Avon lady, the vacuum cleaner salesman, the Bible salesman, pest control salesman, driveway repair salesman, roofers, and on and on, and I remember those. But as households began to need two incomes, and the lady of the house was no longer home because she too was away at work, door-to-door sales became less productive. And I'm curious, for those of you who grew up in Fairbanks, what types of salesmen came to your home offering door-to-door sales here in the Golden Heart City? If that happened, call in and let us all know. Now, Alfred Fuller, who was born in Wellsfield, Canada, was the 11th of 12 children in his family. Well, Wellsford was a small farming community. And from the Fuller.com website, quote, Alfred's father would often look at his hands and say, "These are your fortune, boy. Be suspicious of anyone who shows you how to make a living without using them," unquote. Fuller's parents pushed him out of the house at age 18 to find a career, and that's when he moved to the United States to live with his sister in Boston, Massachusetts. It was 1903. And Fuller said of himself that he was, quote, "a country bumpkin, overgrown and awkward, unsophisticated, and virtually unschooled," unquote. Fuller was quickly fired from his first three jobs, which were a trolley car conductor, a gardener, and a horse groom. So his career began at age 19 with a job at the Somerville Brush and Mop Company, and he had success as a salesman for them. And here's another quote from Fuller himself about himself. "I washed babies with a back brush, swept stairs, cleaned radiators and milk bottles, dusted floors, anything that would prove the worth of what I had to sell," unquote. So it seems to be a pattern in many of the human interest stories that I tell that successful businessmen or military men had roots in large families, often with rural farm backgrounds, and often had little money. And I attribute that to having to work hard to keep the family going and having to be somewhat humble and a team player to keep the family afloat. So from Wikipedia, quote, "A self-described country bumpkin, he felt his success was attributed to his farm boy charm, his ability to make his customer feel comfortable, and his full money-back guarantee," unquote. So 3 years after arriving in the United States and working for Somerville Brush and Mop Company, Alfred Fuller, on New Year's Day in 1906, started the Fuller Brush Company in Hartford, Connecticut. Now, Fuller's initial investment was $375 for one hand-operated wire-twisting machine, spools of wire, horsehair, fibers, and hog bristles. And there's a photo of the original machine at the Fuller.com website. From that website, quote, "From a bench between the furnace and the coal bin in his sister's New England home, young Fuller set out to make, in his own words, the best products of their kind in the world," unquote. So Fuller had three rules right from the beginning: make it work, make it last, and third, guarantee it no matter what. He manufactured brushes in his basement shop and sold them door to door. By 1913, he began hiring representatives, independent contractors, to sell door to door for him, thus expanding his territory and income. And from America Comes Alive, quote, "Part of the attraction to men joining the sales force was Fuller's conviction that this was the land of opportunity. Anyone could make their way in the world." One of Fuller's favorite sayings was that the word American terminates in I can, the I can, the last four letters of the word American, unquote. By 1914, with World War I and the United States entering the war, Fuller Brush supported the war efforts, making specialized military brushes. One picture on their website shows Fuller Brush service kit, which looks like a grooming kit for our military men. By 1919, about 13 years after he started his basement brush business, his sales had grown to over $1 million a year, and that was a lot in 1919. And I worked hard on that basement brush business alliteration. Short side trip here. Did you know that under our customs for spelling in the English language, there are not words with triple letters in a row? If a word might have triple letters, we break it up with a hyphen into two words for readability, like cross-section, bee-eater, shell-less. But you can have a word with three consecutive double letters, like book-keeper. So think about that. I'm sure Mr. Fuller did not go off on mental side trips like I do. He probably stayed right on target to be as successful as he was. And talking about a man who manufactured brushes and staying on target, did you know that if you served in the Korean War or World War II, you may have been issued bore brushes or general purpose action brushes made by the Fuller Brush Company to clean your firearms? And again, from America Comes Alive, I learned that, quote, "During the Korean War, it was only natural for President Harry Truman to invite a Fuller Brush man to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to talk about the best brushes for cleaning guns. Fuller made brushes for this purpose in World War II as well," unquote. And you can find some of these vintage Fuller Brush M1 Garand cleaning kit brushes on the web for sale. Here's one from a site, Marstar CA, which is Canada. Quote, "U.S. military M1 Garand cleaning kit brush, $9, issued in World War II, manufactured by the Fuller Brush Company, These were added to the cleaning kit as a general purpose action brush, 3 inches in length with a tin spine and brown bristles, a fine addition for the military collector. And I'll tell you about another one right after this commercial.
Days, prospectors flooded into the interior to make their fortunes in the shiny yellow metal. It was hard work. Tools and supplies were shipped up by riverboat, then out to the mines on rough cut trails. There was a lot of waiting involved. Nowadays, all you have to do is walk into Century Hardware. That's how it works. You need a tool? Century has it. No waiting involved. You get your job done fast. Century Hardware. What you need right now.
Hey, Interior Alaska, it's Steve with Auto Trim Design, and lo and behold, winter is upon us. Never step into your cold vehicle again with a remote start from Auto Trim Design. Plus, with Drone Mobile, you can start your vehicle with your phone from almost anywhere you have cell service. Call or stop by today to schedule your remote start appointment at Auto Trim Design and take back the season. And as Ben says,
we will be here when the other guys are gone.
KFAR weather.
Snow likely today, otherwise cloudy skies expected. Highs level off around 13, northeasterly winds around 5 miles per hour. Snow likely tonight, 2 above, cloudy skies. Tomorrow, highs around 13. A dusting of snow today through tonight with another inch Saturday through Saturday night. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Currently, it's 8 degrees below zero.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255, 458-TALK. What is on your mind about firearms today?
And we have a caller.
We have a caller. All right, caller, you're on the line.
Looks like they
upped it. All right, are you on?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Murph. I kind of hated to interrupt your story because it was interesting, but I do have a question, gun question for you.
Yes.
Okay, so what I was wondering about is if I purchased a holster so that I could carry on my body a concealed carry.
Yes.
And I wear a shirt or something long enough to cover it.
Yes.
But the bulge of the holster and gun can be detected, but not easily discernible as to what it is, would it still be considered a concealed carry?
Well, it would be considered a concealed carry, but it wouldn't be properly concealed. So that's called printing, when you can see the bulge or you can see the outline of a gun on your body under your clothes. That's called printing. And tell me what you're thinking about.
I'm thinking about three different ones. I'm thinking about one for under the arm, one for around the waist, and one like maybe at the thigh or ankle, depending on.
Okay.
I like to wear a lot of skirts.
Sure. And what gun are you thinking about putting in this concealed holster?
That's a 38.
A
38 special.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're dealing with a revolver, and that has a little bit larger profile. And
Okay.
And I have a number of concealed holsters, both leather and Kydex from 40 Below, for my 38 specials because I carry the SP-101. And so you can go there and they can fix you up with something that will work very, very well for you. And you just need to wear a sweatshirt or a looser jacket or a vest over it and you'll be able to conceal it pretty well. And wear clothes that are print. Print hides much better than solid colors. And you might also use things that have gathers or pleats rather than that are tight and come straight down. And cotton or a woven fabric works better than a knit fabric for hiding things.
Okay, awesome. Great.
One more thing. You are in an environment where you're outside a lot, and if you use an ankle holster, that gun is going to get pretty dirty down there.
Yeah.
So okay. And you can always call me at home if you have more questions.
Okay, thanks, Laura.
Okay, bye, Murph.
Bye.
Okay, bye. All right. So Liberty Tree Collectors is a website with collectible military firearms, parts, and accessories. And they have some of these same brushes for $8 a piece. Now, this is not an earth-shaking emotional history report for today like I do sometimes. It's a rags-to-riches story of one of America's innovative entrepreneurs who used his factory's resources to support our war efforts, and even if it was as simple and as lowly as the brush. Now, here is some nostalgia and wishful thinking. If we could have the Fuller Brush Man of boar brushes these days, we could have a boar brush that lasts for a lifetime instead of 10 minutes, and with a money-back guarantee. Anyone cleaning guns lately knows the poor quality of today's boar brushes. And here is a description of some of Fuller's vintage boar brushes from DuPageTrading.com, if any of you are inclined. The tag on the box reads, Brush Cleaning Caliber 30 M2 procured for the U.S. Rifle Caliber 30 M1 made by the Fuller Brush Company, date pack June 6, 1945. And Glenn, I think you need a box of these. They're just $80. Quote, World War II sealed case of 100 boar brushes. Most of the cases are dated in the spring, summer of 1945. These are USGI brushes made by the Fuller Brush Company during World War II. They are not, and they're not as in capital letters, the flimsy made boar brushes that are on the market today. Offered here are made of brass when quality was the watchword. Keep it as a nostalgic box of brushes unopened after 70 years, or use them up and feel confident they will last more than just a few swipes or break off halfway through the boar, unquote. And I am so glad to see I am not alone as a boar brush complainer. And I will end this saying, I'm happy to know quality boar brushes did exist at one time in history. And one more thing, if anyone has the idea to be a door-to-door salesperson these days, dogs were a problem for those salespeople. Fuller taught his sales force to enter a yard looking confident, walk briskly, and to keep their briefcase between them and the dog. And he told them, in reality, they would probably get bitten once every 4 years. And Fuller's dog system worked so well that the U.S. Post Office asked him for advice on dogs and mail carriers. So let's move on to a gun subject. Let's move on to snakes. After waiting almost a year, my new Colt Anaconda arrived. And I've passed up a few of the 8-inch anacondas because they're too big for me to handle. But finally, a 6-inch anaconda came in, and I zipped over to Alaska Ammo to purchase it. Now, the older production of the anaconda from 1990 to 2003, it came in 3 barrel lengths, 4, 6, and 8 inches. But the new production, starting last year, 2021, is only being offered in the 6 and 8 inch lengths. And I'll talk more about the gun after I have time to shoot live ammo with it. But there really isn't a long storied history on this gun. The original models are just from 10 years ago, 1990 to 2003. The Anaconda was brought to market by Colt to compete with the Smith & Wesson 29, the Ruger Redhawk, and the Dan Wesson Firearms Model 44, all offerings in the 44 Magnum caliber. And it's kind of ironic that Wesson Firearms was brought out by CZ USA in 2005, and last year CZ Group, a Czech holding company, bought the Colt Manufacturing Company, and news articles say that Colt will continue to be manufactured in the U.S.
We have a caller.
All right, caller, you are on the line with Laura.
Hey, Laura, this is Ron.
Hi, Ron.
Since you're into the snakes, I saw just yesterday.
Yes.
They have come out with a 3-inch python.
Oh no! Don't tell me this.
There goes another $1,500 of your hard-earned money.
That $1,500. I think they should discount them for less inches. Well,
maybe a senior discount. For
yeah, me. Senior discount. Well, you know, a short person needs a short gun, right? I've got to have a 3-inch python. Well, now you've both made and go ahead.
I guess my height must keep changing because I feel the need for, you know, a broad spectrum.
I know. Well, now you have both made and ruined my day because I got to find $1,500.
Oh,
The good part is it'll probably take another year for this to make it to Fairbanks.
Yeah, and the fun stuff will probably come Friday. I just picked up a PDP that I haven't shot yet, so I'm going to try it out.
Oh, well, then give us a report. Yeah, this is, thank you for telling me this. I did not hear this anywhere. Where did you find this out?
I was on the net, and one of the places I generally go is Shooting Illustrated.
Ah, okay.
Very, very brief article. I don't think anybody's actually had one in hand yet.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you for this information. I'm going to...
Oh, by the way, they do say it weighs approximately 44 ounces, so I don't think it's for ankle carry.
No, it's not. It's not for ankle carry. And that's a little, that's actually a little heavier. Well, I don't know. I actually don't remember what my 3-inch SP-101 weighs. It's definitely heavier than my 2.25-inch ones.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I'll cut you loose.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you. All right. Now, talking about CZ, they supply armaments worldwide, and I am sure they'll make good use of Colt's name. Now, my initial reaction is that I really like the Anaconda. The trigger press is very, very smooth. I like the exposed backstrap with no material from wood or rubber grip back there to move my hand away from the hammer. I can easily cock the gun with one hand. Now, pay attention for those of you with small hands who want a 44 Magnum for bears, because this will work very well for you with small hands. And that ability, I also attribute to the downward sloping design of the face of the hammer. It's just perfect for me. And not, of course, that I will spend much time shooting that beefy 6-inch barreled gun with one hand, but just in case I need to in an emergency situation, I can. Now, the Anaconda has been named Gun of the Year last year by several publications, and now I have a really good idea why. It's a 44 Magnum, but of course I can shoot 44 Special for practice, and if I use it at all, it will probably be for bear protection, being more powerful than my 357 Ruger GP100. I plan to head over to 40 Below Holsters soon to have a chest holster made for it, and I'll set it up so I'm drawing more out to the side to accommodate the longer barrel. And that is what I like about 40 Below's holster strap system, their chest holster strap system, is that a person can pretty much create any position for the chest holster to accommodate fit for their preference. They have a 4-point system on that holster. And I'm pleased as I can be with that trigger design on the Anaconda. It's wide and it has vertical serrations. And so far, I've only dry practiced with it, but with that shape of trigger, I can place my trigger finger with the crease of my first digit right alongside of the edge of the trigger, and that makes one-handed firing the gun easy for my small hand. I have more leverage that way. And this trigger reminds me of the older guns people put trigger shoes on. So cocking the hammer or pressing the trigger in double action is just as smooth as it can be. Now the Anaconda, like the Python, has a linear leaf spring action, so there's no stacking when you pull the trigger. The current new Anaconda has been redesigned from the older models, and it's been redesigned to accept what I've read is described as an oversized Python action. Now the frame is bulked up for the higher caliber, but I was pleasantly surprised to feel how well balanced the gun felt in my hand one-handed. And true to the vintage Anaconda, this one has the full lug and ventilated rib barrel. Now the Anaconda comes with a Hogue overmodeled grip with, as I mentioned, no material over the back strap. But there's no rampant Colt logo seal on the grip like on the wooden grips, and I miss that Colt seal. And I'll read you that you can interchange the Python grips onto the Anaconda. I read that, but if it's a wood grip, I would personally not like that on a heavy gun because I think you'd feel more recoil. I think it's going to be nice to have that rubber grip to absorb the recoil on that 44. I love the finish on the gun. I had to do a double take. It is just beautiful, what Colt calls a semi-bright stainless steel. Now, I don't think I would personally hunt with this gun, but it is drilled and tapped for optics, and I'm reasonably sure people that bought the 8-inch model will enjoy hunting with it. And for me, all I can say is bears beware. Now, Melissa's laughing. Do I have time to start a new subject, or are we going to our...
We got about 30 seconds.
Okay, before I start the next subject, I'm going to read the safety rules so we all remember them. Always keep the gun pointed in a safe direction. Always keep your finger off the trigger until ready to shoot. Always keep the gun unloaded until ready to use it. Every time I read these rules, I think of Joe Nava and thank him for teaching me what I know. And I'll talk to you right around the break.
Sings raggedy music to the cattle as he swings back and forward in the saddle.
Keeping Fairbanks in the right frame of mind. Tanana Herb Company, proud sponsor of KFAR Radio.
News. I'm Rich Dennison. President Biden today says the government plans to double the number of rapid at-home COVID-19 tests to be distributed free to Americans.
I mean, 1 billion tests in total to meet future demand.
The president today also announcing the government will make the most protective N95 masks available for no charge. Military medical personnel are also being deployed to hard-hit states as COVID hospitalizations hit new record highs. The Labor Department says there was a rise in the number of Americans filing for new unemployment claims last week.
The number of new claims for unemployment benefits rose 23,000 to 230,000. The Omicron variant of COVID is causing disruptions in the job market, though the number of people still receiving benefits declined to 1.5 million.
Fox's Jenny Casola. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The Fairbanks Daily News Minute reports that the Fairbanks North Star Borough population grew by a smattering between April 2020 and July 2021, according to data released by the Alaska Department of Labor Workforce Development Census Office. The slight increase of 0.1% was largely driven by military transfers to Eielson Air Force Base in connection to the base's F-35 program, according to state demographer Dave Howell. Overall, the Fairbanks North Star Borough population grew by 1,860 people in 2021. Fairbanks was the fastest growing borough in the state, Howell said. We saw a big increase in the military population there. After the Fairbanks North Star borough, the next area to grow was the Mat-Su borough, which gained 1,724 people. Howell said the state also saw a decrease in outward migration, in large part due to the pandemic. Alaska has seen a consistent trend in people leaving the state since at least 2013. The state population peaked at 743,000 in 2016, but the overall number of people leaving has outpaced those moving to Alaska.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
Ride into winter with a friend, your Snowway Snowplow. Snowway plows are stronger, smarter, the most reliable plow in the industry. Their wireless controls eliminate messy dash installations and provide the ultimate in-cab flexibility. Better yet, Snowway's patented down-pressure hydraulics increase your plowing efficiency by 30%. The drive-in mount system hooks up in seconds, and their structural plow warranty is the best in the business. Stop by Rogers Auto Repair, your Snowway dealer on Dale Road near the airport, or call 479-6665.
When you think about the blessings of this great country of ours, the list is long. Yet, freedom is chief among them. Freedom to live your life for you and your family. Freedom to keep and bear arms. Freedom to travel without unreasonable restriction. Arctic RV helps their customers exercise their personal freedoms on the road, exploring and camping in beautiful Alaska. Although Arctic RV is closed for the season, they will reopen Monday, April 4th. Arctic RV, rough it in style. See you this spring.
Hi, Steve with Auto Trim Design. Be it work or play, your truck bed will take a beating. You need to protect your investment with an Arctic Spray-On Bedliner from Auto Trim Design. Our Arctic Spray-On Bedliner was developed as a commercial coating for use on the Alaska Pipeline, which is exposed to our extreme Arctic conditions. Why should you or I settle for anything sub-quality? Get your Arctic Spray-On Bedliner today at Auto Trim Design. And as Ben says,
we will be here when the other guys are gone.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255-458-TALK and let us know what's on your mind about firearms today. And unfortunately, Ron, now that you've told me about that 3-inch python and Melissa looked it up on break on her phone, I don't know if I can concentrate on anything else. I'm too excited about that gun. Okay. Next time, call in at the end of the program and tell me about new pythons. Okay. I want to talk about another history subject, but this one will be covered over a number of weeks. And what set me off on this journey, it was finding out one of America's famous Old West lawmen passed away. Wyatt Earp passed away this day, January 13, in 1929. And I will talk about Wyatt Earp's life in a future program. He's a whole program to himself, especially the story of the famous gunfight at the OK Corral. But when I read that January 13 was the day Wyatt Earp passed away, I got to thinking that he was, at one time in his life, in the 1800s, a shotgun messenger on stagecoaches when they transported Wells Fargo treasure boxes. And if you remember last year, I think it was May 20th program, I talked about Wells Fargo because William Fargo was born on May 20th, 1818. With Melissa's careful keeping of the Shooter's Corner archives, you can re-listen to that May 20th, 2021 program. When I was talking about Wells Fargo, I said I'd talk in the future more about the company and the riveting stories of some of its more famous shotgun messengers and coach drivers and the guns they used. I had purchased a book titled Shotguns and Stagecoaches, The Brave Men Who Rode for Wells Fargo in the Wild West. It's by John Bosenecker. Starting this program and in upcoming programs, I'll recant these riveting stories from the book, as well as do as much extra research that I can to add to them. And it would be easy to skip around and tell the story of Wyatt Earp was involved in first, but I decided to start from the beginning. Chapter 1 is a story from 1851 titled Wells Fargo's Pioneer Messenger. He was the first one, Pillsbury Chips Hodgkins. And that will be the first chapter I start with in coming weeks, because first, I want to provide a summary from the introduction of the book, Shotguns and Stagecoaches. Unless I mention I'm quoting from a different source, much of what I'm sharing is information I learned reading that book, Shotguns and Stagecoaches. So if you think about it, humans have always had the need to transport something valuable from one place to another. Even before gold and jewels and money, we transported a most valuable resource, food, first in animal form, dragging the animal to the cave, and later in agrarian society, moving grains. And sometimes even water need to be transported, and still is today in some remote areas. And through history, we have had to find safe ways to transport what's valuable to us. Quote, from marauding brigands attacking desert caravans to pirates on the high seas to robbers of Wells Fargo's stagecoaches and to modern hackers stealing identities on the internet, security has remained one of our greatest challenges, unquote. And as we know, if you have something of value, chances are someone might want to take it away from you. And we constantly create new, safer methods to transport and send valuable items. In our society today, data is the new frontier. The crooks and hackers are not far behind. If you lived in the West or the trails heading west during the 1800s, you likely were not safe. And the dilemma back then was how to safely transport goods and money from the East Coast to the untamed West Coast, and how to transport gold back to the East Coast. It was the Wells Fargo Company that paved the way to cross-country economic transport and growth. Now, Wells Fargo would not have been successful if it were not for, quote, the valiant shotgun messengers and detectives who protected its treasure, its stagecoaches, and its railroad express cars, unquote. So it was during the California Gold Rush that Wells Fargo came into being. Wells Fargo provided both express and banking services. It took in gold and silver. It provided cash and items that settlers and miners needed. Wells Fargo followed the money trail. When new mines and towns appeared, Wells Fargo serviced them. And in turn, the robbers followed Wells Fargo's expansion. Quote, the connection between commerce and crime was never more evident than in the story of Wells Fargo. America's frontier regions were violent and lawless in the extreme. As a result, Wells Fargo and the Wild West became synonymous, unquote. Today, when you think about Wells Fargo, what image comes to mind? Now, many think of the brave shotgun guards that rode on top of the Concord stagecoaches. Those shotgun guards fought off highway robbers and mounted Indian warriors. And if you think about it, back then, which would have been from 1852 to 1918, according to the book, Wells Fargo Express was woven into our society. And think of it as the equivalent of today's Federal Express. The Federal Express delivering mail and packages all across our country. We consider it, some of us consider it safer than to ship by U.S. mail. Now, I learned that in towns, merchants hung what is called call cards in their shop windows, and they were meant to signal to Wells Fargo messengers that a package was ready to ship. So when a Wells Fargo messenger saw one of these call cards, he would stop his horse-drawn wagon and pick up the package for shipping. The book notes that 99% of Wells Fargo's business was routine delivery work. Quote, it was that 1% that made Wells Fargo stand out from every business enterprise in American history. The company's relentless battle against thieves, highwaymen, and train robbers. Wells Fargo hired tough men who were good with guns to protect its express shipments. It employed crack detectives to unravel robberies and track down bandits, unquote. So there are 20 chapters in this book, each about a different man who rode for Wells Fargo, their adventures, brushes with near death, and sometimes about the guns they used. It was names like Wyatt Morgan Earp, Bob Paul, Jeff Milton, Jim Hume, Fred Dodge, Harry Morse, and there's more. The author considers Jim Hume to be, quote, the most important and most famous express detective of the Old West, unquote. And his story I'll tell in Chapter 9. Once, when two masked highwaymen stopped his coach, Hume found himself, as many of these men did, staring down the barrels of the bandits' shotguns. And in one case Hume was involved with, he did not have one of the Wells Fargo treasure boxes on board, so he didn't see any reason to shoot the bandits because they would just kill him and the passengers. There was nothing to guard. But the bandits did steal from Hume. They made off with, quote, a pair of silver-plated Smith and Wesson six-shooters adorned with a four-carat diamond, unquote. And that was then, and this is now, and I know something about guns, but I don't know anything about diamonds. However, I did a quick Google check, and today a 4-carat diamond would cost between $50,000 and $60,000 to start. It could go up to $150,000, much more, and it depends on clarity and cut. So apparently, these Wells Fargo guys were paid very well to have a guns like that. Now, the book's introduction notes that a lot of information has been written about Wells Fargo, but, quote, no book has ever been written about the express guards and sleuths, unquote. So we will learn over a number of Shooter's Corner hours about 20 of Wells Fargo's best shotgun messengers and detectives in the Old West. It was 1848 when gold was discovered in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada area, but news of that didn't reach the East Coast for another 10 months. And then gold fever changed America, and there was a great migration from the east to west. That's when it began. The book notes that the gold seekers headed to the Motherlode, which was California's mining region, and these gold seekers were mostly young men. Here's a quote from the book. They drank, gambled, whored, brawled. With little or no law enforcement, every man was responsible for his own safety. Thus, 49ers carried Bowie knives and the newly invented Colt revolver. This mixture of testosterone, alcohol, and blue steel was a deadly brew, resulting in extremely high rates of violence, unquote. Now, the problem wasn't just in California. It was all across the nation moving towards the west. The gold booms in Nevada, Idaho, Montana, Colorado, as well as cattle towns in Kansas. There were silver mines in Arizona. And this also included the gold rush to the Klondike. The danger of a bad guy taking a good guy's hard-earned stuff lurked at every step. Now, back in New York, Henry Wells and Williams Fargo, they were financiers, and they figured they could make a lot of money, large profits in California. We are going to go to our third break, and I'll finish this up after that.
It's winter, so it's dark out. Go figure. LED Moose lights literally save lives. At Auto Trim Design, our LED lighting specialists can help you find the best options and sizes for your vehicle. We carry all the lighting you'll need for a safe winter in Alaska, whether it's on your four-wheeler, snow machine, truck, or car. Don't risk your family's life in the dark. Stop by Auto Trim Design today, 2550 South Cushman, to protect yourself for tomorrow.
Explore winter trails you never thought possible. Stand, float, walk on snow with better traction and stability than walking down the street. Modern snowshoes are the perfection of a thousand-year-old idea. They're lightweight and versatile, easy and fun to use for all ages. If you can walk, you can snowshoe. Get the exercise you crave. Let it snow. Go explore. Start today. No lift ticket required. But first, find the right style and the right fit at Frontier Outfitters. Frontier Outfitters, for your Alaskan lifestyle.
Weather brought to you by GCR. Alignments protect your vehicle's steering system as it extends the life of your tires. Book yours at GCR Tires and Service, the Tire Guys, taming the Alaskan Road, Van Horn at Cushman.
KFAR weather.
Snow likely today, otherwise cloudy skies expected. Highs level off around 13, northeasterly winds around 5 miles per hour. Snow likely tonight, 2 above, cloudy skies. Tomorrow, highs around 13. A dusting of snow today through tonight with another inch Saturday through Saturday night. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood. Currently, it's 8 degrees below zero.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255-458-TALK. And what is on your mind about firearms today? So, at the time, I was talking about Henry Wells and William Fargo, that they were financiers back in New York, and at that time, they owned the American Express Company. But another competitor, Adams & Company Express, they were express shippers, had already began operating on the West Coast, and they had been operating since 1849, and that was a year after the gold rush began. So in 1852, a few years later, Wells Fargo & Company in New York was organized, and soon after, they opened their first office in San Francisco. And back in those days, there was no such thing as local delivery. There was no local mail or package delivery. Shipped goods were transported by private express companies, is what they called them, express companies. And most of these were small companies. Wells Fargo's business model was to buy out these smaller competitors and expand rapidly by buying increased market shares. And if any of our listeners or investors or business owners, you know a business can expand either by organic growth or by acquiring market share. And Wells Fargo and Company did both. Not only buying out competitors, but as the West was being settled, they experienced more and more organic growth. So to give you some idea of the rapid growth of Wells Fargo, here's a quote from the book. By 1866, they had 146 offices and carried express on 4,000 miles of stagecoach lines. 10 years later, it had 438 offices throughout the West, operating on 6,000 miles of stage lines, and by this time the railroad kicked in, so in addition, 3,000 miles of railroad lines. As the railroads expanded, so did Wells Fargo, which grew exponentially. In 1890, they had 1,654 offices. In 1910, they had 5,643 offices, and in 1918, they had 10,000 offices throughout the United States, unquote. And that gives you some idea of the amount of commerce Wells Fargo controlled up to 1918. And Wells Fargo was one of the United States' largest businesses. It had 35,000 employees. But then something happened in 1918 to cap their exponential growth, and that was World War I. So with wartime emergency, the federal government merged all express companies into one, the American Railway Express. And that affected Wells Fargo's overland shipping of goods. And the colorful history of Wells Fargo as a pioneer express company ended in 1918. However, their very lucrative banking business was not affected. Now, many of us think about Wells Fargo as a stagecoach company. They did own and operate some stage lines in selected areas in the West. They were what is termed an express company. Their mission was to carry letters, packages, and other valuables, but not passengers. And though Wells Fargo did own some of their own coaches and bought interests in other coach lines, they mostly contracted with and paid local stage lines to transport their what they called green strong boxes. And if you go to the Wells Fargo website under stories, there's a write-up about the famous green strong boxes, and they're also called treasure boxes. And they have their own history and they're highly collectible. And sometimes Wells Fargo transported its customers' valuables in iron safes, but the majority of express items were in what was called Wells Fargo's signature wooden treasure boxes. And that's what the robbers were after. They'd say, throw down the treasure box or throw down the green box. The treasure boxes were mostly kept beneath the driver's seat, but sometimes under the passenger seat in a coach. And there's a story about these boxes. They were mostly made by a Maine-born master carpenter named Joseph A. Ayer, A-Y-E-R, and he began crafting the Wells Fargo treasure boxes in a San Francisco shop in 1862. He used heavy pine and oak for the boxes and used iron to reinforce the lid and the sides and the corners, and he affixed an iron hasp closure so the box could be secured with an iron lock. And his boxes were painted forest green and stenciled with Wells Fargo and Co. lettering in white on the front. And Ayers put his maker mark inside the box, J. Y. Ayer, 3740 17th Street, San Francisco, SF, Cal. And so if you go to that website, Wells Fargo's website, you'll see a picture of the inside of one of Wells Fargo's train cars with their men guarding several of these boxes along with a two Wells Fargo iron safes. And I found one of Ayers' Wells Fargo treasure boxes up for auction at Christie's with a realized price of $8,050. Estimate was $8,000 to $10,000, so maybe some of you will find one in the wild. When the Transcontinental Railroad was completed in 1869, Wells Fargo made increasing use of shipping by train. And here's a quote from the book. During the 1870s, as railroads expanded throughout the West, Wells Fargo express cars, usually coupled behind the tender and in front of the baggage car, became a common sight, unquote. And the tender was the car that the coal, these were steam engines, it was the fuel car, but they stored the coal and the wood and oil in there. And we know what we now know what the Wells Fargo treasure boxes or green boxes are, and that's what the bad guys want. So now let's talk about the messengers and the agents. The Wells Fargo Company first employed messengers during the California Gold Rush. They carried letters by horseback and mule to and from the mining camps. And later, Wells Fargo messengers, it was later that they transported gold treasures from the mines via stagecoach and riverboats to San Francisco. And these messengers carried guns because they had to do battle with the highway robbers. Here's a quote. In the 1850s, if a stagecoach had a large shipment of gold on board, the local Wells Fargo agent would guard the treasurer. Wells Fargo agents, contrary to popular belief, were not secret agents or detectives. They were typically merchants who owned the Wells Fargo franchise for a town and operated a Wells Fargo office inside their general stores. Their principal duty was to send and receive letters and packages. Wells Fargo agents also acted as bankers by buying gold dust, unquote. And it was during the 1850s that hold up stage cultures became common. And that increase in holdups prompted Wells Fargo to authorize its local agents to hire armed guards. And it was these armed guards who were referred to as shotgun messengers, and they would accompany the treasure shipments. And in America, it was Wells Fargo that pioneered the shotgun messenger system in the 1850s. But the concept originated much earlier in England in about the 1780s. Armed mail guards rode on stagecoaches, so the tradition already existed. The book has some poor quality photos of Wells Fargo's shotgun. It's a Parker made in 1879, a Remington made in 1893, and an Ithaca made in 1970. So if you want to see pictures of these Wells Fargo shotgun model shotguns on the web, it's best to do a Google search for them, because the book does not have very good pictures. Now, all of this history and terminology, I'm hoping, will help us understand the stories that I summarize from the book on future programs. Quote, the term shotgun messenger did not come into popular use in the West until the 1870s. Such terms as shotgun rider and riding shotgun were coined by 20th century fiction writers and were unknown in the Old West, unquote. And I want to read a longer paragraph from the book about the guns these shotgun messengers used. Quote, Wells Fargo messengers on stagecoaches and trains carried sawed-off, double-barreled shotguns and occasionally a revolver. During the 1860s and early 1870s, the company's shotguns were muzzle-loading percussion guns purchased by Wells Fargo from San Francisco firearms dealers. Percussion firearms were difficult to reload and became obsolete after the early 1870s as metallic cartridge firearms came on the market. In 1874, Remington and Sons began making affordable breech-loading shotguns, and they were quickly loaded by snapping open barrels and inserting a pair of brass shells filled with buckshot. Wells Fargo first used the Remington shotguns, and later those of other makers, including Parker Brothers and L.C. Smith. All of them were 12-gauge double-barreled hammer guns, and they were known as messenger guns or cutoff shotguns, unquote. So back when I talked about Wells Fargo on the May 20th program, I noted that since manufacture of these messenger guns was farmed out to various suppliers and gunsmiths, each of the guns could be different and the markings can be different, as well as how they were marked Wells Fargo. So it's difficult sometimes for historians to accurately identify an actual Wells Fargo shotgun. And there are imitations out there on the antique market. So if I recall in that program, I also mentioned that Wells Fargo did not necessarily supply their messengers with the shotguns. Sometimes the guns were supplied to the messengers by the contract carrier, and sometimes the messengers personally purchased them as authorized firearms. And sometimes, once in hand, the messengers modified their own guns. So shotgun messengers were a select group of people. Wells Fargo shotgun messengers did not guard stagecoaches. Their job was to protect the Wells Fargo Express boxes, those treasure boxes or green strong boxes. Now, most regular Wells Fargo stagecoaches did not even have a messenger on board. They only put them on a stagecoach if that coach was carrying a large shipment of gold or coins. That's the only time you had the shotgun messengers on board. And this will give you some idea of the growth in valuables Wells Fargo carried over the years. This is a quote. By 1861, Wells Fargo employed 16 shotgun messengers. As Wells Fargo's businesses expanded, so did the number of holdups, and so too did the number of guards. Even more were hired as Wells Fargo expanded its operations beyond California and into other western states and territory. By the mid-1870s, the company had 35 shotgun messengers. They grew to 110 in the early 1880s, and by 1885, they had 200. By 1918, they employed 3,000 shotgun guards, mostly on the railways. Every Wells Fargo card had at least one armed messenger and often a messenger's helper. And I'm going to stop here. I want to remind everyone that Glenn Miller will be on the program next week. So write down your reloading questions and call in, and I'll talk to you then.
This has been Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio. Brought to you by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. To listen back to this or past episodes of Shooter's Corner, go to KFARradio.com and click on the archives page. For more Shooter's Corner on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.